Okay, I'm Diane Livingston, and I'm here with Tom Clarity from Park City, Utah. And today is November 7th, 2020. And we're doing an oral history today about Tom's life and his experiences in his life. And we're also going to be talking about his experiences with COVID and in light of religion. So I've known Tom for, what do you think, Tom? At least 5 years.
It's been 7 years, yeah.
7 years, yeah, a long time. And he's a very good friend of ours, a good friend of my husband's. And so before we begin, Tom, may I please have your consent to record this interview?
I consent.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So before we begin, ask the narrator some questions about COVID, I'd like to kind of talk about your childhood and growing up, because 50 years from now, when people listen to this tape, they'll want to know who you are and where you're coming from, so to speak. So why don't you just tell us, maybe start with where you were born, and if you can think of anything that you feel you'd like to share about your growing up years.
Right, yeah, well, thanks. This would be a fun opportunity. So my parents were both raised in the city of Philadelphia, in the suburbs. And then right before I was born, moved to New Jersey, and the part that's sort of close to Philadelphia, sort of the Cherry Hill area. And basically I was born there. That was my first, but when I was four, so some of my very earliest memories, we moved to this beautiful area in Pennsylvania called Chad's Ford. It's a very historic area. It's near Valley Forge. It's near the Battle of the Brandywine and where all these areas were. I guess you would call it sort of Southeast Pennsylvania. And that was a really neat place to grow up. And I think it affected me more than growing up probably some other places because it had a ton of colonial history. And so for me, as a kid, we got to go on field trips and both with the family and with school to places that were really important in the founding of the country. And so that, I guess that really impacted me. And just living not my house, but many neighbors lived in these historic houses. And I had a friend named Kurt who lived in a house that supposedly George Washington stayed in many, many years ago. And so he was sort of a neighbor of mine. So that was neat, and went to a number of different parties at his house as a little kid over the years. And so I think growing up there wound up kind of leaving an impression on me for my whole life and about the how neat of an area it was and what a neat time it was to in our country and sort of the founding, not just geographically, but also in the old sense of the word, politically, because a lot of ideas, like, you know, as a kid, I went to go see the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia and, you know, learned about William Penn and, you know, we go to New York City and see the Statue of Liberty and all these sort of things. And so, and, you know, I went to Washington, D.C. as a little kid and got to see the Constitution in the, you know, the vault where it descends down every night. And so these sort of things, I guess, left an impression of the worthiness of the ideas of the foundation of our country, that that these were, you know, lofty ideals that had been written down by a bunch of people who were working really hard to make the best possible system they could, and their motives were entirely altruistic for humankind. And so I think that was sort of the impression that I got. And yeah, so that stuck with me for a long time. And also the intersection there of there was absolutely no separation between church and state. They were integral together. And I think that the people over time have come to see that the founding fathers definitely said there shall be no religious test for people to hold office. And so, and there should be a separation of church and state. And I think what they meant, if you read their writings further, was the fact that there shall be no specific, religious requirement for people. But I think that they couldn't even fathom that folks would I think that they really understood very clearly that in order to have the government that they lined out for people to work, that folks had to share the same moral values that everyone at that time shared, basically bar none. And even those who at that time, even those who didn't necessarily follow all those values, they still understood them, and they still understood that they were worthy to strive for. And so that, you know, maybe they didn't always reach them, but they understood, you know, just like everyone, that, you know, they were worth attaining and worth working hard for and teaching your children about all these sort of things. So that was a neat place to grow up.
Wonderful. Thank you. Tell us, thank you so much. Great ideas about our founding, and I share them. Tell me about maybe your parent. Did you have siblings?
Yeah, I do. I have one sister. She's 2.5 years older than me, and she took great care of me. Okay. Excuse me. She took much better care of me than I took care of her because I was just a little brother. But and so I just took it for granted that, of course, there'd be someone there who would always help in every possible way.
What is her name?
Kate or Catherine. With a K.
Okay. Let's see. And as you were growing up, did you have any special hobbies that you liked?
I did, yeah. Well, the thing I liked the most, I think my parents would tell me, and those who reflect upon it, was being outside playing in the woods. That's just what I liked, because we were in these beautiful forests, and I would just spend every day outside. I never wanted to come in at all, no matter what. And sleep.
What
in
did
my
you
bedroom.
Do out there?
Bedroom window. I'd make forts and just go play and look for the animals and try and find the animals and get as close as I possibly could to the deer before they would eventually run away. Over time, they got to know me. They'd let me get, you know, maybe 15 feet away, and then I never got any closer. But I always dreamt as a little kid of petting them. Playing outside. And then as a little kid, that's what I love to do. And then every summer we belonged to an outdoor swimming pool, which was neat. And so every summer we just spent, felt like every day, all day is what it felt like, at the pool and swimming. So became a good swimmer. Pretty good swimmer actually. And then playing soccer, and then Scouts was actually a big influence in my life since a very young age. I guess that was maybe second grade or somewhere around there. So lots of once a week scout meetings, and then even in the summer, 2 weeks of scout camp for Boy Scouts. That was the Boy Scout, you know, everything that Baden Powell wrote down was basically how to take the ideals of, you know, what our country was about and instill them in young men. And little kids, all the way from little boys all the way up through to be young men. And of course, then I played soccer all through. So sports-wise, soccer was big for me all the way up through till the end of high school. And then skiing as well. So my dad was nice enough that my mom doesn't like to ski, but my dad was nice enough that he would drag us out to the local mountains called the Poconos, which were pretty good, actually. They're definitely good enough to learn to ski. Nothing like the Rockies where we live now as far as the size and the magnificent powder. But they were definitely a great place to learn to ski. And so every weekend during the winter, we would go up on Saturday, and he'd wake us up early. And, you know, my sister and I would kind of fall asleep in the car. And we'd get there and, you know, we'd always be there for the first run and stay to the last run. And so that was really fun. And I remember listening to music with them in the car on the way up, and how important that was and how much fun it was to get excited. You know, we'd watch the sunrise and ski all day. And then usually once or maybe twice a winter, my dad had a work friend who had a house there up in the Poconos. So kind of a cabin, actually it was a cabin, smaller cabin. Smelled great of wood on the inside. You know, one of those unfinished wood cabins that just smelled terrific. And so we would go and stay there for maybe a week during the winter, once or twice. And then every once in a while, we'd go back in the summer as well, which is neat. And his name was Alex. And so it was Alex's house. And lots of good memories are there.
Oh, so fun. Sounds like you had a really fun childhood.
Yeah, no complaints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell me about education. Did you like school when you were a kid?
I have fond memories of, like, a lot of my friends, I remember them saying, you know, man, I couldn't wait to be out of school. But I had fond memories. I still have fond memories of school. My elementary school was basically called Penn's Woods, Penn Wood, which stood for Penn's Woods. And it was named after William Penn, the founder of Pennsylvania, which is kind of neat. And it was indeed back in the woods and had these giant picture windows. And so I was, you know, the kid who liked to look out the window and dream of being outside playing. Yeah. but I did fine. I did great. Got good grades. I think the school district where we grew up was a good school district. And so we got a strong education. Definitely prepared me for college and later in life. Science, for sure. Yeah, for sure. Science. It was always science.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so, as I know, you did some education, following high school. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. And then, so I had a good time, you know, going through that school district all the way, you know, through high school. And then I decided, well, I think I might want to major in environmental science because I was pretty into that. And so I looked for a college that had that, and I chose one that was, not too far away from home. And it was, and again, a really nice place. It was a school that called Elizabethtown College. And the second, probably the most important thing that happened to me there was the second week of freshman year. I was in biology 101, a big lecture hall, taking all these courses for, you know, related to science. And I saw this really studious girl sitting up in the front with brown curly hair, wearing glasses, taking lots of notes. And I thought, I was sitting, you know, halfway back and thinking, I already know all this stuff. What is she doing taking notes? And that was definitely true for about the first 2 weeks of school class. And then it got really hard. And I realized, oh, that's why she's taking notes. And so I started studying with another lady named Rachel. And so she sort of became my study partner. And one day into Rachel's room walks Stacy. And I said, oh, that's the girl who's sitting up front studying so hard. I thought, man, maybe I should be her study partner. And so that's how my wife and I met, being study partners for Biology 101. That was definitely we started dating maybe a little while later, or courting. And never looked back. And so we were 18 and met then. And that is obviously, like, by far the, you know, probably the biggest blessing in my life, being able to, you know, that's something everybody dreams about, right? And so that actually, that happened. And so I'm eternally grateful for that. So we're back in education. So coming back to education, so college was great. I got to, the first summer I went out and I said, I better get an internship. And as I just kind of heard, that was something that people did. So I said, I do this. And so I asked all around, and finally my dad knew someone who worked at an environmental science company. And so that was the initial contact. Then I went and I interviewed for the internship. And I was really excited to go. I don't know what I was going to do. They're like, save the planet, I think, during that first freshman year. And so I was pretty excited to go do that. But instead, I sat in an office in front of a computer and did Excel all summer long. It was a really boring internship. And I thought to myself, oh, man, I hope this isn't what environmental science is like. And so it caused me to sort of branch out a little bit farther. And my wife, Stacy, was pre-med. And even in college, or sort of early college, she was admitted into this thing called the Primary Care Pre-Admission Program. So she was actually one of just a few kids in the state of Pennsylvania who was accepted in the med school right out of high school. So her grades were so good. Yeah. And so I knew somehow that's at that point in time, you know, my interest in medicine sort of started. I didn't really have much of an interest except listening to and talking with her. Coming out of high school, I didn't have much of an interest. And so then I started sort of veering towards computer science and medicine together, and biology. And so pretty much the rest of my career has been a mesh of those three together. And so then after after we graduated, she went on to med school and I started working at a computer science company. And then I spent a couple of years there. And then I was trying to think, okay, well, what can I do at Penn State? Because that's where she was. And I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And, you know, I wasn't really sure what to do. And so I wound up getting, I wound up having another gig with NASA and the Mars Society, which was a short but impactful gig, that where we actually got to go to the Mars Desert Research Station and do a bunch of science. And it turns out that I wound up with the as the lead on the science project, so that was kind of neat. So I was the XO of the mission, but the lead science officer, and we tried to plan out very, very early on how it was that we could use a data network for also do positional awareness, because we knew someday when we get to Mars, there would be no GPS system. And when eventually everybody knew that you're going to have a rover and you're going to drive around and collect rocks. And once you get far enough away from your HAB or the, you know, sort of the main base station that, you know, you would need to know where you were. And on the first mission, it might be easy because you could trace your tracks back. But then after that, you know, it'd be more complicated. So in designing this science protocol and testing all this and all these sort of things, I caught the interest of some of the folks at Penn State. And so I wound up being hired on there after that, which was really fun. And that's when I started getting into academic medicine and doing some postgraduate work there. And then eventually went on to sort of have my first really neat job other than the NASA one, which was the director of research planning for neurosurgery. So that was really fun to be able to probably the best part other than the science was just the people. Really, really fun people to work with every single day. And so that was a huge privilege as well.
Wow, that's amazing. That is really amazing. It's so fun to hear all the different things that you did so early on in your career.
Yeah, really. I was lucky.
Yeah. And so then you got married, the two of you got married and you have two little girls who are growing up. Tell us a little bit about what they are about. I love that. Well, they're adorable.
Yeah, that was fun.
Anything you'd like to share about that?
So I was sitting in my office in neurosurgery and Stacy walks in one day and surprises me with the news that we were pregnant. I'll never forget that day. Our first child there. And that was just about, I guess it was 11 years ago or so. My heart did something it's never done since. I really just couldn't believe what I felt. Felt like as soon as she told me, I knew that sort of the rest of my life would be different. And I wasn't quite sure how until 10 months later. Or actually, I'm sure it wasn't 10 months later. It was probably, 7 months later. And it was neat, really, really neat experience having our first daughter, Anna Maria, because we had her at the hospital where we both worked. And so it was a really community and social kind of thing. Like our friends we did lots of friends there. And they would just come in and see us and, be supportive and bring food and, It was a really neat birth. And then Anna Maria took a long time to come out. It felt like, a day and a half, but I think it was really just 23 and a half hours. Wow. So that was quite a thing, but everything worked out great, thankfully. The docs were great. And then, those first couple nights in the hospital. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I love nature and the snow. I've always loved the snow. And on the day we drove her home from the hospital, we had a big snowstorm. And so it was kind of fun. We only lived a mile and a half from the med center. And so it was fun to put her in the Jeep and drive home through the blizzard on the first day. And she loves the winter and the snow as well. So I think it stuck with her. And then when we came to Park City, we were, when we were in Minnesota, between Hershey and here in Park City, we spent 1 year in Rochester, Minnesota for a fellowship year for my wife at the Mayo Clinic in autoimmune neurology. And so while we were there, Cecilia started her journey on this earth. And then when we moved out here, she was very pregnant. Stacy was very pregnant. So we were just hoping that she wouldn't deliver on the drive from Minnesota to, because there's not a lot of infrastructure between here and there and on Route 90. And then let's see here, we were here about just a month or two, and we had Cecilia at the University of Utah, which is another neat experience. And I was settling in for a 2-day labor experience, but she came out in about 4 hours. That was really quick. So I was, much to my surprise, I said, wow, that was fast.
Here we are.
So yeah, so that was kind of neat. That's when I learned that Anna Maria was destined to be a big sister. She was just the best big sister that I think I've ever seen anywhere. And that's widely repeated claim of fame by all of our friends who have kids that watch her interact. So she's just such a good person in taking care of others, including herself.
How sweet. Nice to hear your little thoughts about Anna Maria. Tell us a few sentences about Cecilia, because she'll want to hear something one day.
Right, right. And so Cecilia was the doctor who delivered Cecilia. This really sums up her first minute outside the belly. Lifted her head up and looked around the room and almost kicked the doctor. And then Dr. Tilly, who delivered her, said, I've never seen a kid lift their head up, right after being born and look around the room. She said, but there Cecilia has. And so that was kind of a neat thing. And that sums up her entire personality. Lifted up her head, looked around the room and almost kicked the doctor. And so she continued to be like that. And my wife Stacy and I say she really, really wanted to be able to do all the things that her big sister did. I mean, with a passion. So when she was little and couldn't crawl, even move, anything like that, she just was watching her sister all the time. And then just, you could see the struggle to be able to, walk. And so she did walk pretty early because of that. She kind of went right from, okay, I figured out how to crawl, and like, couple days later she's like, this crawling thing is no good, I'm going right to walking. and that's she's a very, very determined child, and she was an intense baby, I'll definitely say that. But then for as intense as she was during as a baby, she is an absolute joy now. She's just my best little friend, and she's has a true heart of gold, which I'm sure it came from the loving example set by her sister. And so they're both, they're definitely each other's best friends, which is great. Yeah. And I hope it stays that way forever.
Yeah. What a treasure. That's a happy home.
Yeah.
Let's see, I'm just going to look here. We kind of skipped over, you talked about working a little bit, but you didn't. Did you graduate from college, I assume?
Oh, yeah, from Elizabethtown College.
Kind of share that.
Yeah. And then started doing, so that was fun, but somewhat uneventful because you kind of get kicked into the real world. So congratulations, you're out and go find something to do. And that's kind of how I felt. So I thought to myself, So I see my kids now have a gap year because they sit around for a year, thinking about what to do and travel the world. But, when I graduated, that wasn't too common of a thing, and I didn't have anybody who would want to pay for that. So I, said, I better go find a job. So I just, when I first got my job, it was the intersection between the newspaper and the old fashioned job listings of the newspaper and the internet. I remember looking at both for my first job and circling things with a pencil, but really the internet had taken off, all the action was there. That I went out and, found a neat, really neat computer company that was doing neat stuff, that I was once again, lucky to get hired onto. And had a really, that was a smaller company. So it actually was almost funny. It almost felt like a little family, the group of us. That was a neat group. I still think about those folks. In fact, speaking, because I know that part of our conversation today is about the pandemic, and it's funny. I think I've been hearing many people wound up thinking about folks that you've known a long time ago during the pandemic. It's definitely changed dreams for a lot for me. And so I think about stuff from the past more. And so it was funny to look back and think about, you know, how those folks affected you, and also mold your work ethic as well, which I think is interesting. So I think that, the example of what your first job is, I think, at least for me, and the intensity of work winds up sticking with you. So anyway, that happened for me. And so then from there, after graduating from Elizabethtown, and then getting my first job, I didn't start my postgraduate work until, I don't know, whatever that was, like six or 7 years later. Actually, that's not true. I did a bunch of graduate classes at Caltech for the NASA stuff, which was neat. But then, my real, that was kind of like, because I knew I really wanted to do something in space, but, I guess like any little kid, I said, who wouldn't want to be an astronaut or just do something fun for that. And, but there was just none of that, in Pennsylvania. The aerospace industry was very weak in Pennsylvania. Now Penn State itself actually does have a pretty neat aerospace program. But I wasn't really thinking of that. I was thinking about jobs, what I could do to earn a living. And so that's how I got into medicine, which is neat. And, medical companies and biotech and all these sort of things.
So you went to do some graduate work after that?
I got lucky because when I was at Penn State, as an employee, you can take as many classes as you want, as your department chair will let you, which is pretty neat. For either free or next to free. So I just gorged myself on information, which is really neat.
That sounds just like you, Tom.
Yeah.
gimme, what you got?
yeah. So that was really neat, super neat. And you actually have a real job and so you're getting paid, which is important, especially, because keep in mind, Stacey was, she's done, the 4 years of college and then 4 years of med school, and then four years of a PhD with 1 year in folded fellowship. And then another, 1 year, after she did the MD PhD program, which is pretty neat. And so then after that also yet another year of fellowship. So there is a lot of learning going on, and not a lot of earning.
Right.
So
that was important too. For a job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that helps.
That's great. Do you, and so I would just ask, now, what kind of hobbies and interests do you have now?
They're pretty much all the same except for soccer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I learned when I got older, that, the sports that stick with you are the things I sort of call lifetime sports. And, they don't really include, at least for most people, like things like football, because, you get older and you're like, it's probably not a good idea to go crashing into somebody else because that's going to hurt and it's going to last a while. So now some folks do, they're pretty tough. But for most people, I've learned basically lifetime sports are things like running and volleyball, swimming, all these sort of things you can do, either on your own or in a pickup team. And so for me now, I'm still skiing a lot and running has become a real joy for me. I love running in the mountains here in our neighborhood. It's just so much fun in these beautiful single tracks that we have, which are just the small little paths that go all throughout the mountains. And so I love mountain running. It was tough for me the year we were at the Mayo Clinic because it's very, very flat. So there are no hills, basically, there are very few hills. But running through there was quite a different experience, running flat and then coming out here. It was tough, but I learned to love that challenge. And so now I barely run anything flat anymore. It's just all up and down. So that's kind of even more so more fun than skiing for me is just running. I'll do it all seasons of the year. I'll go on little snowshoes and and run in the snow. And I always like it if there's a bit of a crust that keeps you from punching through too often, which is nice. And but regardless, I'll just stomp down the pack. And I just love being in nature and getting the joy of being able to locomote yourself through and take a tour of what's new in nature today. Because it's all every day, it's a little different, which is fun. So I enjoy that. And then, I'm not playing soccer anymore, but still running and skiing and swimming.
I'd love to see you with your children. You're a really good dad. You really are a really good dad. I can see that you're getting a lot of joy from being a father.
I am. Yeah. Well, they make it easy. They're really, it's nothing for me to brag about because they're just such good kids that they make, you know, being a dad a joy. It's a privilege to be able to watch them grow up and try and help steer them in the right direction.
You have a big, busy household. Your wife works full time. You're working full time, I assume. And then you've got the girls who are going to school. And so what does that household look like? I'm kind of curious.
Well, it's it's helped. When the kids were, it's definitely helped. A lot of our friends that, both do sort of the same thing as us, they wind up using a nanny to basically manage schedules. But the fact that years ago, I kind of got into the biotech transfer and startup world and other startup companies as well has helped my schedule be flexible enough that between whatever flexibility Stacy can squeeze out and what I can do that we haven't had to use a nanny. So we get to, one of us is always, there with them to pick them up from school or drop them off at school, which is really nice. And as they get older now, they'll be able to, just take care of themselves doing that. We're basically there now, but, now we're with the pandemic, it looks a little different. So the balancing and juggling act, has changed, because now the kids are doing their school remotely, still with the school district, but basically they've managed to pretty quickly transition their entire curriculum to be delivered over computer. If people are listening to this, 50 years from now, they'll probably think back on what kind of computer this was. Well, this was something that was called a laptop, and it had a keyboard that you used your fingers to type on, and then another piece that was perpendicular to that called, it was a screen that was just a two-dimensional representation of things. And that was probably will be as foreign to them as the typewriter is to Anna Maria and Cecilia. But, we've learned to go from the one room schoolhouse to, we're sort of back to that now, but with the teacher, but the teacher's not there. And the teacher instead is, over the telegraph wire, which has become the internet. And we're really blessed in the fact that Cecilia's teacher is fantastic. She has figured out how to pivot her teaching career to deliver, Cecilia is only in second grade. And so part of the education there is how to become a student and how to feel part of a classroom. And so somehow her teacher has managed to make that work over virtual education. And I was amazed. And actually when my parents were out visiting, they got to see it as well. And they were both amazed. And my mom's a retired teacher. And so for her she's not easily impressed at all. And so for her to be impressed by this was pretty neat for me to see as well. And so right now the balancing the household looks like we all get to sort of wake up together and have breakfast together. And then, each retreat to our corner of the house to do our daily things all on computers, which is kind of neat. And of course, being a physician, you do have to go in occasionally. So my wife goes in, as needed. But some of the stuff, some of the patients actually enjoy remote teleconferences. So occasionally she can do those as well from home. And so there's the one thing the pandemic has brought about is a surprise resurgence in home life, which is really neat. And I think it would be really, really hard if we had little babies, because one of the things you really want to do, at least we did, and I think as shared with every parent that I can remember, is you really, really want to get out and about with the babies and go do things. And so I think that would be, it probably is, if I had to guess, really challenging for those little ones. But we're just at the right age of second grade and fifth grade, where and we're lucky to, you know, live on a lucky and blessed to live on a parcel with you know, where they can run outside anytime they want and play, which is nice. So I think it's also probably more difficult for folks who are in the cities, and there's plenty of outside places for them to do, but they can't just run out for 10 minutes as easily, you know, and unsupervised, and then run back in and do some of the schoolwork. So I'm sure they're finding ways to make it fun as well, but the girls have almost effortlessly found their own ways to make it fun and have a good time. And it'll be interesting to see now, heading into the winter, because the summer has been great. The spring's been great. The summer, fall has been great. Because, you know, you can have these outside play dates with, you know, one or two kids. So, you know, you make sure you're trying to limit exposure to everybody. But now with the winter coming, I guess they'll all be sledding play dates. Mm-hmm. I guess we'll see. and so, yeah, we'll see what happens. But that, I'm sure that's quite a bit of a change. So the household looks like we're spending way more time together. Everybody's staying happy. We haven't been jumping down each other's throats. And I think that Stacy and I have been actively working to make sure that doesn't happen and trying to steer everybody. So we're putting in a little effort there, to try to keep the family spirit high, and that sense of togetherness high. But it hasn't been a ton of effort because the girls are just little angels. They're just good. They're helping us through as well, which is neat. And so,
that's really fortunate. That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, this has been wonderful, and I feel like we've really gotten a good taste of you and your life, and the things that you've done. And you have lived a very rich and rewarding life. At least it feels like to me.
Yeah, thanks, and to me as well.
Yeah, really. Okay. Why don't we, is there anything else you'd like to share before we move on to the second section of our interview? Any other thoughts?
No, I'm ready.
Okay, great. So as we know, as you of all people know, you and my husband are talking all the time about COVID and the effects, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
To me. But as we know, COVID has affected a lot of people around the world, and many people are wondering how COVID has been affecting people. And you talked a little bit about your family life, and then another aspect that people are asking questions about is that of worship and faith. And so I'd like to move on to this part of the interview and just hear from you your experiences with COVID with respect to religion. But first of all, what did worship look like for you and your family pre-COVID? Tell us the faith that you belong to and believe, and what it looked like, kind of.
So both my wife and I are raised Catholic, and you know, based both in Pennsylvania. And so when we met, we thought to, you know, it was pretty easy to tell that she shared really early on to tell that, you know, she shared the same values as I did. And then to learn that we were both Catholic, I remember even being a little kid, you know, 18 years old, or I guess I would call that a young adult, but now it feels like a little kid. And, you know, to think, oh, that's a bonus, you know, like, wow, she's Catholic. So, you know, somebody of the same faith, like this is great. And then I also remember thinking in the back of my head, oh, my parents are going to like this. And so that was neat. And, you know, worship for us, was every Sunday. When I grew up as a kid, I can literally say we missed almost no masses. Every Sunday we were there at church, you know, with the rare exception that somebody was sick, and then, you know, the rest of the family would go. You know, I guess, yeah, you know, probably somebody stayed home with us, but we'd have to be pretty sick to not go. And so, you know, I remember as a kid as well, thinking to myself, you know, I don't know if I want to go, especially as an older kid, really, you know, I don't know if I want to go on Sunday and, you know, look, I want to be, you know, playing outside in the woods or doing whatever else. And, but nope, didn't matter what we thought, we went every Sunday regardless. Just wasn't up for discussion ever, no matter what. And every once in a while, my sister and I would maybe try and bring it up, and we would just learn, nope, not up for discussion. And so we'd all go. And I, you know, I'm really grateful now that they did that, because it's, you know, a super important part of my life now. And so I also remember my mom once saying, I think maybe I was in college. I remember her saying, you know, something saying to one of, I think it was my aunt, saying to my aunt, you know, if the kids aren't going to mass or to church during college, you know, that's okay because they're going to get back to it when they have kids. And I thought to myself, that's weird that my mom knows that or thinks that. And I sort of filed it away in my brain. I can still remember saying that. And it turns out, you know, that she was right. You know, I guess probably during college, I really didn't go all that much to church, but it, you know, it remained the fact that I went from the time I was zero all the way through till, 18, every single week. Not only was it important, I find there's a huge overlap between spirituality and morality. And so just an absolutely huge overlap. And so I was grateful, I guess, in college for the, at that stage of my life, for the, and I think I maybe even realized it then, for the moral base, not just the spiritual base. And so, but, you know, of course now, you know, I have the benefit of hindsight, which is neat to think back on things. But what did it look like pre-COVID? So it looked like Sunday mass. No matter where we were, even on vacation, we would try to make it and rarely miss. And then we would pray in the morning together as a family, and then we'd pray before dinner. You know, sort of say grace, and then. At night, the kids would say their prayers, and so we would do that all together.
Okay, so that is pre-COVID.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know about you, but I can kind of think back when I realized that COVID had hit.
Right.
COVID hit us all, and, you know, quickly we had government regulations that were starting to be impressed upon our religious centers, whichever kind they are. And I wonder how, you know, do you remember things that your church had to implement based on regulations that were put on?
Yes. I remember in March, sort of seeing all this, watching it come like a very slow tidal wave, just coming and coming and coming, and hoping that it would, you know, collapse and get pulled back into the ocean like all surf waves do. And hoping that it would, you know, it was looking ominous, but would break in on itself as breakers do. But it, but knowing that it might not, and you know, kind of we were preparing, you know, as a religious education teacher myself, and so, you know, watching all the kids come in, and you know, we started out with the, you know, making sure kids were washing their hands and these sort of things. And then, you know, knowing that, looking at the slope, we spent a lot of time looking at the slope of the trajectory, you know, is this logarithmic and how does it look? What's the doubling time? How many days did it take till, you know, caseloads were doubling? And then also what was our hospital capacity? And so as I watched all these things come, you know, it seems like, all the churches did a really good job of, you know, seeing this coming and preparing and then transitioning. We had a 0 weeks of lost mass. We just as the county that we were in basically imposed restrictions on in-person religious services, the church, St. Mary's in Park City, we had a new pastor who actually had only been there maybe 2 years at the time. His name is Father Gray. And he just immediately spun up doing everything online and didn't miss a beat. And, you know, he's sort of a younger guy, in his mid to late 30s. And so, you know, that could be an advantage technology-wise, the fact that he was familiar with that and comfortable doing it. And so he did great. I think everyone was really relieved to see his face every single day. So he did it to this every single day, sometimes multiple times a day, you'd be there. Wow. Yeah, it was really neat. Yeah, without missing any. I think the first one that he missed was you know, maybe 2-3 weeks ago, and here we are in November. He had to take a day or two off. And so I give a ton of credit to him, and he just, you know, has the calmness and the clarity of heart to be able to deliver really meaningful messages to everyone who's listening, you know, not just with our faith, but sort of tying it into scripture as well. And so he's been a real blessing in our lives, that's for sure. So his transition to that was great, and it goes on. It's still going on even to this day. We've since reopened, I guess, a couple months ago, in-person services. And so people, he'll do both. He's still doing both. So I'm sure his workload has grown, but he does it without complaint and seemingly with joy.
Wow. So does he just record himself and then he puts it on, or it's a stream?
No, live. It's live every time. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Zoom meetings. It's amazing. Zoom is somehow, I give credit to the engineers of Zoom to be able to scale their business thousands of fold without hiccups.
For sure. Okay. So it hit, you guys shut down for a short time, it sounds like, and then they got back into the in-person.
Yeah.
Were you able to see your friends when the lockdown started? Did you feel like you were able to see the people that you usually saw? Or did you feel like you guys were kind of isolated? How did you feel?
Huge feeling of isolation for sure, but it just made the experiences all that much more important and cherished when we had them. And so thank goodness, like the best thing that happened to the pandemic was spring, at least for those in the mountains, because, you know, spring happened. And so all of a sudden we could see people outside. And so we were, both my wife and I were careful, both to not catch it ourselves, as well as to make sure we're not giving it to anybody, because, you know, keeping in mind, she is a physician, so she does get exposed. So we would simply sit up on in our yard and spread out some lawn chairs and visit with people, just like they did in the olden days. And so we'd have visits, and so that would work out great. And in fact, together, you know, we had a visit where we walked up Pineburg Mountain together with you guys, which was really neat. And so, you know, we still have these really neat moments. And I guess in a way, it's a really returning to our not so distant history of when people were more spread out, you know, sort of in the colonial era, and you wouldn't have a visit all the time. And, you know, if you were sort of on the frontier when you did, it was very special. And so I tried to look at it that way, actually. So there's, for both my wife and I, you know, this, it's just a small little blip in our life. But for our at the time, 6-year-old, you know, this represents like a tenth of her life, or even at the time it did. And now it represents, you know, it's coming into a whole year. So really it's a, you know, a sixth or a seventh of her life. And from what she can remember, you know, it's basically half her life. And so it's much more, I'm constantly aware of and trying to, you know, figure out ways to make sure she's still having fun and interactions and visits. And luckily she does have some good friends here in the neighborhood. And so she's able to see them, which is really nice. But again, I think of those with younger kids who haven't quite established a friend group yet. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I would imagine be extremely challenging for them.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah. It's been hard for our little grandchildren.
Right.
Okay. So, I was kind of curious about, I don't know what you call your sacrament in the Catholic Church. Is it the Eucharist? Do you call it that?
Yes. Yes.
So how, like for us, we had to not have the sacrament for a little bit, and then we started taking it at home. Did you guys have any sort of changes there?
Pretty much exactly the same. You know, until in-person mass resumed, no one had the sacrament. Now, I think that if you requested it, that you could, you know, probably drive up to the church, and I would be, you know, very confident to think Father Gray would find a way to accommodate people, and probably some did, but you know, we just have done without for quite a while.
So, but it's resumed now that it started.
Yes.
And is there any difference as to way they administer it, or is it just the same?
I think it's, you know, more or less just, you know, people are still wearing masks in church. And so, you know, they're, you know, basically receive the Eucharist and then you walk a couple steps away and then, you know, pull your mask down, yeah, sort of thing.
Okay. Very similar to what you were doing before. But yeah. You still wear masks. Are you guys socially distanced in church?
Yeah, people are spread out a little bit in the pews as well. You know, one of the interesting things that changed, not just mechanics wise, but it was neat to see the hundreds of people on the Zoom meetings, on the virtual masses, just hundreds of people showing up. And so that was really neat to see, because we could all basically see the other participants. And so in one sense, it was, you know, lonely and isolating. In another sense, it was a tremendous spirit of fellowship and community, because you thought, okay, you know, here's everybody else, you know, coming. And, you know, here is the group of the faithful. And so that was pretty neat to see, and encouraging. And you could do it every day if you wanted to, which is pretty neat. Yeah.
Do you feel like there were as many people who were Zooming in as who usually come, or were there more?
I felt like even more. There was a small, at least in the darkest days, when people were most scared, there was definitely a time where it felt like maybe even more. The people that, you know, would only come to church occasionally, we sort of call them the, I think it's a long-standing, sort of the Christmas and Easter crowd, you know, who'd always be sure to come then. You know, I think maybe a lot of those folks were showing up too, which was really neat to see.
That is really neat to see. How nice for them to be able to have that strength.
Right.
Is there anything that you think that you've thought about doing at home to during that lockdown period when you couldn't go in on Sundays? It sounds like you were pretty busy though with your church still on even a daily basis. Were there any other things that you felt like you needed to do to replace the fact that you weren't there in person, or did you feel quite satisfied with the Zoom calling?
Well, I definitely didn't feel fully satisfied. You know, there's no substitute for, you know, being in God's house, as they would say. And so that, you know, you miss that all the time. But, you know, fondness makes, distance makes the heart grow fonder. And so it just it kind of makes you not take for granted the mechanics of going to church every week, which is easy to do, to small extent. Even if you don't do it completely, to some small extent, you think, okay, there it is. There's, and so now it's, you know, something that people, or at least in our family, you know, look forward to, and, you know, actively, all the time. And so that's, you know, there's been that benefit out of it, I would say.
Has this experience affected your faith? It sounds like you're looking forward to being there. Do you feel like it's helped or hindered your faith that lockdown period, and even since then?
Wow. Well, I do think I've been doing a lot of self-reflection about this over the past couple of months, and I do think it's helped quite a bit. And I've learned a bunch of things. One is no need to watch scary movies, because you know, here it is. All the scariness is here right now. And so I got to myself to thinking about the fact that that our society, humankind, peoplekind has been you know, would think it was funny or interesting or cute to you know, watch a movie where, you know, something terrible was happening. And so in a way you think to yourself, you know, like there's some disaster, right? A disaster movie, these sort of things. And so, you know, like, well, why do we watch this? Well, we know it's exciting and it's interesting to think about. And so what I've realized is that, nope, that's not exciting. It's all terrible. And it's not something to be, you know, to look forward to watching or living or experiencing. What is exciting is the everyday normal life in a peaceful society. That's the exciting thing. And so one of the self-revelations that I had was that, you know, we're so lucky to live in a country that was, you know, founded based on, you know, founding fathers who, you know, thought so much about how to make a moral society, how to make a moral country. And so, you know, to have a return for us to I guess the Romans called it bread and circuses. So to steer away from the bread and circuses and focus on, you know, what is important. Well, you know, working together as a community for common goals, for the, you know, the benefit of those in the community, and to as large extent as possible, the benefit of all those in the community, and to the benefit of those who are serving the community. And so to realize that serving the community is in itself has intrinsic value to those that are actually serving, and to be able to refocus on those things was really neat. One of the things that that I didn't mention earlier, but when I was at Penn State, I got into pandemic preparedness. And so I started working there on that. And I think you're probably aware of the fact that I started a ventilator project there. And so to see when sort of this pandemic was brewing in China, in Wuhan, to see that building, you know, I was really tuned into that and watching what was happening. And not looking forward to it. Like I had just, you know, like I mentioned before, it was the tidal wave of dread, which was, you know, crashing down in Wuhan and to many other areas of China, and was, you know, threatening to make its way across the sea. And so for me, you know, I started praying really early on when, you know, at the very beginning of this, and hoping that we would find a way to attenuate the problem. Both as society and then, you know, for the world. So one of the things that I was able to do, and of course, you know, I worked with a long time ago, was to in some way materially address this problem. And so we started this, we re-kicked back off this pandemic ventilator project, myself and another professor at the University of Utah. And it grew to become huge. And so, one of the things I saw was that the goodness and kindness of humankind is we had a whole number of people at the University of Utah volunteering their time. And then it became the University of Stanford. Stanford University actually joined our effort. And then shortly after that, Brown University joined our effort. Oh. And so it became the Utah Stanford Brown University collaboration, the USB ventilator. And then we had a bunch of commercial companies that were joined, and I was very pleased and happy to see that people were volunteering their time to help in our effort with no expectation of any remuneration whatsoever in themselves. They simply wanted to save mankind, save lives as many as they could. And there was initially a big shortage of ventilators, and that pressure has since been relieved in the U.S., but it does exist in other parts of the world. And so right now this became a worldwide effort, and one of the professors at the University of Stanford, Manu, had contacts in India, where we're now manufacturing these with a company that's out of the goodness of the heart of the company. They donated a lot of money and a lot of employees and a lot of time to manufacture these. And so that was part of the sort of the spirituality and of this for me was everyone coming together just to help with, and they knew nobody was going to get anything out of this. So that was neat to see. And we had no shortage. It just grew and grew and grew. And so, you know, for the darkness of what the disease is and all the consequences of the, you know, economic shutdown and the people who are dying and people who are sick and this, the terrifying nature for many, many families, many people, many individuals, and the loneliness, there were these punctuations of rays of goodness and kindness that just burst through all that and said, you know, here we are. And, you know, we're going to be able to do something. And we did, which is, it's, and you don't even have to be successful, but we, luckily in this project, we were. And so we were able to help folks. And so I learned a couple of different things. One is the fear is not fun because when you're actually doing it, it's not so fun. And so I think that's probably a little message from God, is that, you know, you shouldn't be focusing on those sort of things in life. So I think that's an important lesson to learn. And then that the community is actually strong and robust. It does exist still. And there is a lot of goodness. And I'm sure that it's an impossibility that that wouldn't be connected to, the goodness of the Lord, the Lord being able to touch people to act to help like that. So it's kind of
wonderful. Do you feel like it's been easier or harder to stay strong in your faith in God during the pandemic? I think they answered it a bit, but
definitely easier because I'm focused on it all the time. All the time, every day, multiple times a day. I'm just always thinking about it.
Interesting. What a silver lining.
Yeah.
Let's see. Has there been anything that surprised you during this experience with COVID, religiously, in any, I know, I'm sorry to put that framework, and maybe you don't have to keep that framework, but is there anything that surprised you religiously?
One thing that was earlier on, I mentioned the huge number of people that we had come and be part of the virtual mass. And so that has whittled down, and there's been attrition. Now, I'm not sure if all those folks have just returned to in-person or not, but, or if people, basically recharged their battery and now they're off and doing something else. I don't know, but it's been a surprise to see that that hasn't maintained itself, and that there's been fewer people, and things have been gone down, and I don't know why. I really don't know why. I've tried to reflect on why that is, and I just don't know. I'm not sure.
I think that I personally think that these are going to be studied times for, this is giving a lot of food for fodder for social, those who study people, sociologists will have lots to think about for a long time. And that's, that type of movement is an interesting, an interesting thing to notice. Would you say that there are fewer people than there were pre-COVID?
It's hard to know because now I'm sure that the parish knows, but for me, I don't know, because there's this split between virtual and in-person. Right. And so I don't get to see everybody all the time. I don't know what people are doing. But we could find that out, by talking to them.
Just kind of curious.
I get the impression that maybe it's back to baseline would be my guess, where we were before.
Okay.
Which still, in a historical sense, is super low. Because if people are listening to this, 50 or 100 years from now, there's been a steady decline in church attendance from when I was a kid till now. And it's really disheartening to see for me.
Mm-hmm. It is. All right, Tom, is there any other thoughts that you would like to leave, parting thoughts to be remembered years down the road about this time during COVID? And that doesn't have to be restricted mm-hmm. to religious. Any other thoughts that you'd like to share as we close?
Well, it is. Our lives are losing enrichment because we're not at gymnastics. And not always at school, and not when doing, even in person religious ed. And there's this that level of enrichment of being together as a society has taken a huge hit. And just going out to eat, enjoying dinners, and these things are still going on to some extent, but they're all attenuated, and they're all not as much fun as they were because of the implicit dread that's always there that, I want to go do this thing, but I'm not sure if I'm going to turn out well or not. So there's always that in the back of people's minds. And even those who have decided to, be brave in the face of the pandemic and, put on a brave face and, there's still that underlying fear. And so as sad as that is, I have found it to be more or less fully counterbalanced by the resurgence in family time and focusing on that. And so you know, knowing that, you know, this too shall pass someday, it's interesting to have this time to refocus on the family. And there's an interesting quote where some people may think that their domesticity is boredom, but in fact, domesticity and one's house is the last bastion of freedom, where one may enjoy oneself to the fullest extent and in any way they wish. And I didn't quite do that quote justice, but it's an important thing to sort of keep in the back of the mind about that. One other thing is, you know, I pray all the time, and I keep, you know, listening for any kind of great answer. But I think the answer so far that I've got isn't, you know, one of those few times in people's lives where you really think you've heard the voice of the Lord or the Holy Spirit or something like that. But I haven't had any, you know, gigantic moment like that. But one of the things that I constantly hear is, you know, basically steady on, like, you know, keep going, you know, keep doing the right things. The right things are, you know, easy to know. We already know what to do. It's just a matter of, finding the strength and the will to make each day happy rather than, a burden. And so I think that that's just something that probably many, many folks are working on at this time. But there's certainly less distractions of society. And, you know, I've been very lucky. The other thing is that the generation of the baby boomers has taught us something. So my parents are of the generation of the baby boomers, and they, I've seen that they've maintained the spirit and the knowledge to, without a beat, they, when they see something like this happen, they say, you know, well, we're going to pivot and adjust and get through it. And there's no complaining whatsoever, which is amazing. There's no settling for anything less than finding a good way through together as a family. So that's been neat to see as well. And so they've imparted some strength on us by looking at their strength.
Wonderful. So, Tom, I have one last question for you.
Yeah.
My question is, what do you hope for the future in your life?
Oh, wow. Well, I hope that our country returns to a God-fearing constitutional republic of people who are, strong in faith, and that morality is strengthened in everyone. The United States returns to the shining beacon of hope and a great example of liberty that it once was and to, that it still is, but it can shine off its tarnish. And I hope that in some way that this challenging time leads us through to a better place. And I continue to hope and pray about that all the time and think in the back of my mind that maybe it will. Maybe there is this is part of the transition to something more beautiful than where we were before. That's what I think about all the time.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you so much for sharing.
Well, yeah, thank you for letting me share.
Yeah, this has been so great. Very wonderful, and we just love you as friends.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you.
So I'm going to go ahead and close the recording. And thank you again.